Les colloques du Collège de France.
So now we're going to have the last two talks for today's colloquium, and we'll continue on information flow with David Bruckner from the Biozentrum in Basel, and he will tell us precisely about information flow in self-organized systems. Thank you, David, for coming.
Thanks very much, Thomas, for the organization and the invitation for this really exciting meeting. So I would like to tell you about some of our work on information and thinking about developmental systems. I talk about something that Thomas has already alluded to, which is a regime where these self-organize, where these developmental systems actually self-organize. Now, I would argue that one of the most spectacular examples of self-organization is embryonic development, where you go all the way from a single fertilized cell to a fully formed and functional embryo. And to undergo this transition, these developmental systems exhibit complex multicellular dynamics, like you see in this microscopy recording of this developing mouse embryo here. And what you see here is how there are thousands of cells that are constantly interacting with each other, both through mechanical forces, like what Lisa has already talked to us about, but also through biochemical signaling and gradients, like what Thomas has discussed in his talk. Now, one of the features that I want to highlight here is that when you look at these systems at the cellular and molecular scale, they're, due to inevitable biophysical constraints, subject to random and unpredictable fluctuations, noise, and heterogeneity. And yet, when all of these stochastic components collectively interact with each other, together, they give rise to these reproducible patterns at the supracellular scale. And for me, this raises a central question that motivates my research and some of the topics in this talk, which is how stochastic interactions of cells can lead to reproducible self-organization. Now, I want to motivate this question with a more specific biological example, which is the patterning of the intestine. And our intestine has these structures called villi and crypts here at the bottom, which are lined with a huge diversity of different types of cells. So at the top here, you have the epithelium with lots of different types of secretory cells that generate the enzymes that digest our food. And that is actually a pretty rough environment to live in because of all this, you know, all these bowel movements and the acidity of the stomach. And so there are cells constantly dying at the top. And because of that, you need these crypts at the bottom where there are stem cells that are the only cells in the system that have the power to proliferate such that new cells go up here. Now, if you think about how this sulfate pattern might initially be organized during development, you might expect that to be an incredibly complex process that relies on lots of signals that are sent by underlying tissues and the environment that somehow instruct these cells into which sulfates they should differentiate. However, people have shown in the last 15 years or so using organoid technologies that you can actually start with a single or a small collection of stem cells, and these cells will grow and divide, and at some point they will undergo a symmetry breaking event where one of these cells or a small number of these cells will make a differentiation event and differentiate into one of these crypt cells, and that will actually kickstart a whole trajectory of self-organization where later you have these large structures that recapitulate many of the features that you see in the in vivo system. And to me, that suggests that these systems somehow have an intrinsic capacity of self-organization, and that perhaps there might be simple rules that we can think about from sort of a theoretical and physical perspective. So to think about that problem, I want to split up this talk into two parts. In the first part, this will be a data-driven part where we basically ask, in this first differentiation event, are there somehow simple dynamical rules that orchestrate the symmetry breaking process? But then in the second part of the talk, I really want to come to the theme of this conference to ask how, you know, given that there is constant noise and fluctuations along the developmental trajectory of this system, how is it possible that these cells interact with each other such that these dynamical rules that hopefully we can identify, they actually somehow generate or self-organize information in the presence of noise. Now, in the first part of this talk, this is an experimental collaboration with the lab of Prisca Liberali in Basel and her postdoc, Cornelia Schweier, who really drove this work, and a PhD student in the group, Silvia Barbiera. And what they can do is to image some of the key signaling pathways that are important during this symmetry breaking event, one of which is a protein called delta, which marks these cells that are the first differentiating cells in the system. Now, they've also shown that before you get this delta emergence, there is a heterogeneity, meaning kind of like a stochastic adoption of different activities of the cells in the organoid, of the activity of a transcription factor called YAP. Now, if you co-localize these images and do statistics on them, what you find is that all of these delta cells are typically also YAP positive, but not every YAP positive cell is going to become a delta positive cell, suggesting that it's somehow necessary but not sufficient condition for a cell to differentiate. Now, I wanted to think about this problem from a theoretical perspective and was motivated by a long tradition of thinking about cell fate decisions in the language of dynamical systems, which was initially proposed by Conrad Waddington already in the 50s. And the way this is often thought about is that single cells are subject to external signals which modulate the internal landscapes of these cells, where different cell states or cell fates are represented as attractors in such a landscape. However, in this system, we're not really dealing with a single cell subject to external signals, but actually with a network of cells that are constantly talking to each other, meaning that each of these cells has its own sort of internal dynamical system, which are modulating each other through interactions, and are also potentially modulated by this tissue heterogeneity, so the activity of this YAP pathway. However, what we don't really understand is how cell-cell interactions can sense such tissue heterogeneity in order to kickstart the symmetry-breaking process. So to develop a model of this, we first focused on this protein delta, which is known to engage in a process called lateral inhibition, where each cell tries to produce some of this delta and inhibit the production of the same protein in neighboring cells. And that generically gives rise to alternating patterns of on and off cells on a 1D line. But here we're not in 1D, but we're actually in a spherical geometry. So what we have to do is to simulate the simple chemical kinetics equation that describes this model on a spherical surface. So that defines the connectivity matrix. So I always draw these networks here of how the cells send signal to one another. Now, if you simulate the simple lateral inhibition process on such a network, it actually makes a parameter-free prediction of how many of these cells you expect to become delta positive on average, which is around 25%, or actually exactly 25%. Now, in the experiment, however, what you typically see is that it's 2 out of 16 cells that initially differentiate at around the, you know, somewhere around the 12 to 16 cell stage. So it's a lower proportion. And I really suggest that there are other factors that are important in this decision making. Now, the simplest hypothesis for how this additional factor that we know to be somehow spatially modulated in the system, the YAP heterogeneity, could affect the expression of delta is that it might just be required for delta production, since we have seen in the experiment that that YAP positive cells are more likely to become delta positive. What that means is that the delta state of each of these cells should be modulated not just by the lateral signal that the cells receives from the neighbors, but also by its cell intrinsic YAP state in this. And it's only if a cell is both high in YAP and receives low lateral signal that it can become a delta positive cell. So you can simulate that model based on sort of a random graph of YAP heterogeneity. And of course, you find that the YAP positive cells are more likely to become delta positive. But this model also makes predictions for what would happen in perturbation experiments if you mess up this YAP heterogeneity. Specifically, it predicts that if you would inhibit YAP, you would no longer get delta cells, which is indeed what you find in the experiment. But also more non-trivially, in the model sort of trivially, what you would predict is if you activate all the cells to be YAP positive, is now, again, all the cells are able to engage in this lateral inhibition process, so you go back to the standard regime of around 4 or 5 out of 16 cells that are delta positive. But this is not what happens in experiments. in experiments, in the YAP activation case, there is no symmetry breaking, meaning that it's really the heterogeneity of the tissue that is important for the symmetry breaking process to happen. So that raises the question of how we can come up with dynamical systems that couple the key factors in the system, the lateral signal, the YAP states of the cells and the delta, that somehow directly senses this YAP heterogeneity. And so what I did was to essentially try and come up with the simplest model combining simple activation and inhibition functions that captures the fact that you don't get symmetry breaking both in inhibition and activation. And actually the simplest model that we found that did that is a combination of three of these functions, and that gives rise to this landscape of delta states as a function of lateral signal and YAP that is has a more intricate shape than what I showed you before. And the way to interpret this is that basically what it says is that YAP low cells have a cell intrinsic bistability where even if the lateral signal is low, they can remain in a stable low delta state, but then they can potentially make a transition over this barrier to become a delta positive cell. On the other hand, YAP high cells kind of have the standard lateral inhibition curve, but there's an offset here that will become important in just a minute. Now, what this model does is that if you stick a heterogeneous network of cells sort of into this dynamical system and simulate, what happens is that all of the YAP negative cells are essentially disqualified from the lateral inhibition process. They're stuck here in this delta low state. The YAP positive cells now receive low signal and they're allowed to go up here, and all the cells in between get stuck somewhere along the way. So for instance, there's the cell over here that's this YAP positive cell, and because it's neighboring another YAP positive cell, it's only one of the two of these that can actually become delta positive. And so that returns out of this initial stochastic heterogeneous network a network with structure where there are never two delta cells that are right next to each other, and there is sort of a typical proportion out of these 16 cells that's chosen. This model then also captures this non-trivial YAP activation experiment, where if you have all the cells in a YAP active state, that means that they're all over here, where they have this intermediate background delta activity because of the cell intrinsic activation of delta by YAP. And so what that means is that all these cells have this intermediate homogeneous delta state, which means they're constantly sending lateral signals to each other, and therefore collectively blocking each other from becoming properly delta positive and breaking the symmetry of the system. And that is indeed similar to what you see in the experiment, where actually in the YAP activation experiment, there's kind of this intermediate homogeneous delta concentration. Now, this model recapitulates the experiment, but it also raises a question of how this cell intrinsic bistability in this landscape that I'm showing you could actually be implemented through molecular mechanisms. Now, from a theoretical perspective, what we could do is to actually write down a molecular model for the couple dynamics of delta notch, which are the two membrane-bound proteins that organize this process. And then in order to get such a bistability, the most generic way that we could find to do this was actually where there's an intermediate variable that links YAP to delta and has this kind of inhibitory feedback to the back here, which gives rise to this cell intrinsic bistability. That, of course, raises the question, what might be this intermediate variable X, right? Can we somehow solve for X? The answer, of course, is always omics. So I will not go into detail here, but basically what Connie and Sylvia and Priska's lab did was to do an ATAC sequencing approach where they identified the transcription factor binding motifs that are accessible in the chromatin in the cells that are about to become, you know, delta positive or secretory. And they found an enrichment of binding sites of this transcription factor FOXA1. So, you know, the question is, might this FOXA1 actually roughly do what we sort of propose here in the model? So for that, the model now makes predictions, not just for what YAP and delta should look like, but also how this FOXA1 should localize it's basically saying FOXA1 should be very correlated to delta, which is indeed what you see in staining experiments. It also says that the FOXA1 should not be patterned in either YAP activation or inhibition, which is also consistent with the experiment. But then the model also makes predictions for new perturbation experiments that we didn't use to constrain our model. Specifically, it predicts that if you make a DAPT treatment, which basically means that the cells are no longer talking to each other through this notch signaling pathway, then what you generically expect is that there are many more delta cells. And the model predicts is that then all these delta cells should also become FOXA1 positive because of this feedback loop. And that's, again, exactly what you see in the experiment. But then the model made even more non-trivial predictions. Specifically, it predicted what should happen if you now do a combinatorial perturbation of both the cell-cell communication and the heterogeneity. So for instance, if you inhibit YAP, the model is saying that YAP essentially now overrules the fact that there's no longer any lateral inhibition, meaning that all of these delta cells that you normally get when you perturb lateral inhibition now disappear, which is, again, consistent with the experiment. And then our model was saying that the YAP activation experiment would fail to break symmetry because the cells are constantly laterally inhibiting each other. And so if you get rid of the lateral signal, then this should recover the state where now actually all of the cells can become delta positive, which is again what you see in the experiment. So to me, this really suggested that this model that we've constrained based on these perturbation experiments really captures the dynamics of the system that senses this tissue heterogeneity and integrates it into a sulfate pattern. But then we also wondered whether we can actually make completely out of sample predictions. So we learned this model on an in vitro data set of organoids, and we wondered whether it can actually say something or at least be consistent with in vivo dynamics. So in vivo, the types of experiments that you can do is that you shoot gamma rays at one of these intestinal crypts in a mouse, which essentially kills the cells, and there's a regenerative response where these where the cells divide again, and they all upregulate YAP initially, and then YAP gets heterogeneously downregulated. And what our model is saying is that once this downregulation happens, is that these FOXA1 positive and delta cells should emerge, which is indeed what you see in the experiment. But then the much less obvious prediction was that if you take a homeostatic tissue and you treat it with a YAP activator, then because now all the cells are active in YAP, all these delta-positive states should be lost. The tissue should go back to a homogeneous state. And that's indeed consistent with what we see in experiments where the secretory progenitors then really disappear upon YAP activation treatment. So let me summarize this first part of the talk. The kind of picture that I'm trying to paint here is that the way that we think these organoids break symmetry is that they integrate initial noise and heterogeneity in the system that's stochastic through a dynamical system that both senses this heterogeneity but also lets cells communicate with one another through this lateral inhibition signaling mechanism. And then out of this input stochasticity returns a sulfate pattern that has some form of statistical structure, right? Like these typical separations between delta positive cells, for instance. So this is an example of how we can use experimental data of a self-organizing system to identify simple dynamical rules that govern that process. But now I want to transition to a more general question of whether we can say something about how these dynamical rules perform in terms of an information processing paradigm. And for this, I want to go back to this contrast of these self-organized systems that Thomas already alluded to with the regime of instructed development, where unlike here, you know, here there's just stem cells, they're totally on their own, there's no mother, there's no egg that gives them any sort of input, which is very much in contrast to the early fly embryo where, you know, this bicoid protein, the initial mRNA, is actually produced by the mother and then diffuses into the egg and provides information to the cells about what cell fate they should adopt in downstream gene expression decisions. So in this regime of instructed development, there's been a large body of work that was introduced by Thomas on thinking about this problem as an information transmission system, where there's an input signal that is passed into a channel that returns an output pattern. And if you want to know how well this channel performs at transmitting information, you can measure the mutual information between the input and the output. In our self-organized organoids over here, as well as in the 3D gastroloids that Thomas showed, that is not the case. There's sort of a different flavor to this kind of pattern-forming process because there's no input signal. There's just noise and heterogeneity that feeds into this interacting network that then returns an output pattern. And our question here was whether we can still say something about the performance of this interacting network in generating these output patterns, and whether we might be able to say something about the self-organized rather than the transmitted information in such a system. So to think about that, I want to simplify this kind of network diagram that I was drawing earlier a little bit. Let's just think about a 1D row of cells again. These cells can interact with each other. And through these interactions, they break symmetry and establish a cell fate pattern, which are these different colors here. Now, because there's noise in the process, that pattern is not going to look identical every time that you run this process, but it actually defines a probability distribution of possible output patterns. So here, this vector Z essentially has as many entries as there are cells, and each of these entries marks a discrete cell fate. Now, essentially, what we want to do is to come up with a metric for the self-organizing performance of such interaction mechanisms that give rise to these patterns and score the output distributions on some sort of spectrum like this, where, you know, we start with systems that basically don't make anything interesting at all, systems that make patterns, but these are extremely irreproducible, all the way to patterns that are extremely reproducible or at least have some sort of correlational structure. Now, we thought about this question from a principal perspective and thought about the various entropies that we could write down about these distributions, which led us to this quantity that we called the utility function that you might want to optimize in order to get an optimally self-organized outcome, which essentially tells us how much information is required to specify this output probability distribution relative to a pure maximum entropy super random distribution. And the way you can write that down is essentially as the Kolbach-Leibler divergence of this observed distribution of patterns relative to this maximum entropy distribution. Now, what we want to use this for, this utility function, is actually as an objective function for an optimization question. So these dynamical systems that give rise to these cellular interactions that that generate these patterns in the first place, in principle, have many parameters, right? How all these, diffusion constants, reaction constants, in principle, maybe also mechanical parameters. And in the previous part of the talk, essentially, we asked the question, right, where in parameter space do we have to place our model in order to describe the data? Now I want to ask a more general question, which is, where in parameter space is robust self-organization possible in the first place? And for this, I just want to give you a simple proof of concept, even though we're, you know, an ongoing work trying to do this in more complex settings, and go back to the example of lateral inhibition signaling. So again, here we have a dynamical system for, you know, the delta concentration in each cell and the signal that it's receiving. There's no YAP in this example now. And just to keep it simple, there's just a single parameter that this model has, that's alpha, that essentially modulates how strong this lateral inhibition is compared to a self-activation in each cell. And what that means is that as you modulate this alpha, you go from a response curve that simply decreases monotonically with the lateral inhibition signal to a bistable system, where for a given lateral inhibition signal, there is actually two possible states, meaning there might be hysteresis in this system. Now, if you consider a deterministic process where there is no noise, actually on both sides of this transition, you can get perfect lateral inhibition patterns that are just, you know, alternating black and white cells. our question is, when we use this noise as a constraint, whether we might actually break the degeneracy between all of these possible parameter choices of this alpha. So what you can do is you vary this noise magnitude, which essentially acts as a constraint on the pattern-forming system. And then I colored here in this plot the regions of the alpha axis where this utility function is close to its maximum at that noise amplitude. So it's essentially coloring the region of the parameter space that's optimal at these different noise amplitudes. And what it shows you is that, unlike in the deterministic setting where it really doesn't matter which of these alphas you choose, as you change the noise, that actually changes which alpha would be optimal at generating these lateral inhibition patterns. And specifically, it says that at low noise, you should pick a monotonic curve because you can essentially read out the input signals quite precisely, whereas at large noise, you should be bistable because then you might make mistakes and due to hysteresis, but at least you have these kind of attractors that the cells can hold onto in the face of noise. Now, that is actually reminiscent of what we saw in these intestinal organoids, right, where we identified this cell intrinsic bistability, suggesting that cell intrinsic bistabilities both allow cells to sense heterogeneity, but also buffer against intrinsic noise. Furthermore, what this at least conceptually suggests is that while in this parameter space there might be broad regions in which a system can perform pattern formation in a deterministic setting, when you actually consider the kind of inevitable constraints due to biophysical fluctuations, then the stochastic noise can significantly narrow these parameter regimes and therefore shape the optima and constrain regulatory mechanisms. Now, with that, I want to give you one additional interesting thing that we can do with this framework, which is that this total self-organized information that we can estimate with this quantity actually decomposes in an interesting way. If you write down the entropy terms into which this decomposes, which I won't go through in detail, but I want to point out that there is two interpretive contributions here. The first one is the positional information, which is exactly the quantity that Thomas already introduced in the context of the developing fly embryo. And the second term is something that was not considered as part of this positional information framework before, that we called correlational information, which essentially scores the statistical regularity of patterns that have no correlation to absolute position at all, right? So saying this pattern as a function of the x-axis, you're equally likely to see a red, green, or blue cell. So there's zero positional information, but clearly it's not a random assembly. And what the correlational information measures is essentially how much the entropy of the ensemble is reduced due to the presence of these spatial correlations. What that suggests is that we can decompose this self-organized information into a sum of two terms. First, the positional information and the correlational information. And we can therefore actually draw this two-dimensional information space and organize the kinds of patterns that I've, you know, sketched here in this talk. First of all, super random or unpatterned states have zero information. Then, you know, the positional patterns are over here with high positional information, and this pattern is over here. Furthermore, at least conceptually, we can also say that, of course, the early fly embryo, as Thomas showed, here is in some state. Okay, maybe I shouldn't have put it all the way into the, you know, absolute optimum, but it seems, you know, pretty optimal as to you know, what can be achieved in terms of the single cell precision. So it has positional information. Whereas these intestinal organoids, you know, especially in the initial symmetry breaking stage, you basically want to pick one out of n cells and it doesn't matter which one, and therefore it's not positional information, but correlational information somewhere along this axis. And of course, you know, that is not something that has yet been measured, so that would be something interesting to do in the future. With that, I want to summarize. So first, I showed how these heterogeneity-driven interacting dynamical systems drive self-organized intestinal tissue patterning. And then we discussed how these self-organized patterns are characterized by this definition of total self-organized information. which provides an optimization principle for self-organizing mechanisms. Now, for me, this information theoretic framework does not really provide any answers or direct biological hypotheses at the moment, but is really a starting point for future research. So I think it raises some very interesting questions. So far, I just showed you how, you know, in a minimal example, we can, like this LATRA inhibition, we can kind of rediscover what we already know. But we actually want to use it as kind of an optimization principle to discover new mechanisms of self-organization and score mechanisms that we directly know from experiments, such as this intestinal organoid example. And then we can ask, you know, what principles make these self-organizing dynamical systems robust? Is there somehow like local adaptation, feedbacks, dimensionality, redundancy of different signals that are being exchanged, which also perhaps to relates to some of what Lisa talked to us about. And then finally, of course, we want to actually apply this framework directly to high-resolution experimental data, like what Thomas is generating in his lab on these 2D on these 3D gastroids. Now, with that, I want to thank you all for your attention, and I want to especially thank my collaborators, especially Cornelia and Sylvia, my postdoc advisors, and also the students that are currently doing PhD rotations in my group. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.